Welcome to a special opening day edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Don Gagne, filling in this week for Ken Rudin. Is he at Yankee Stadium where the Detroit Tigers are playing today?
That's where your heart is, Don. Indeed. I have no doubt of this. And I'm sure that's where Ken's heart is as well. But Ken is actually in the field. He is visiting Oklahoma and Idaho as part of NPR's Impact of Government project. Mm-hmm. But back in Washington, the Nationals are having their first game here today, too. But not that much attention being paid to them. It's a rainy day. It's a cold day. It's a lousy day for a baseball game, but a great day for politics.
There are other things going on in this town. Certainly a lot of action on the Hill, but there is a rally taking place today. The Tea Party Express gathering at the Robert Taft Memorial.
Memorializing the former majority leader in the Senate, Robert Taft, from the early years of the 1950s.
So here's what the Tea Party calls this rally. It's the Continuing Revolution Rally. So obviously a play on words there. The logo crosses out the S and replaces it with the V, so it's revolution, not resolution. But sending the message, we're still here, we're watching you, and they've probably given Republicans more to worry about than Democrats since this new Congress began.
It's interesting that they're having the rally exactly where they are, not only because they're over there on the Senate side, which is controlled by the Democrats, and they're sending a message there, but also because they're gathering around the Robert Taft Memorial. In his day, Robert Taft was known as Mr. Republican. A lot of people thought he was going to be the presidential nominee in 1952. It was Dwight Eisenhower instead. But Robert Taft was a conservative Ohio, and in those days, Ohio represented the Western wing of the Republican Party in a lot of people's minds. And they were the conservative wing, the anti-spending wing of the people who were not so sure about foreign involvements. And while that's 60 years ago now, almost all the issues that Robert Taft was salient on and important on are with us in a very real way today, not only because of the Tea Party tax and spending issues protest that's going on, but also because of four different hearings that are going on Capitol Hill today about our involvement in Libya.
Exactly. We have, finally, members of the administration testifying today. The Senate Armed Services Committee is one of the places where
Senate
hearings.
Foreign Relations, Armed Services in both chambers, the whole gang.
It's the follow-up, of course, to the president's speech on Libya this past week. I was in Ohio when I watched the speech. And I have to tell you, when you get outside the Beltway, sometimes you realize that the world isn't consumed by the things that we're consumed with here. And frankly, there wasn't a lot of buzz. It didn't feel like he moved the needle one way or another on it, at least where I was.
Where were you in Ohio?
I was in Columbus.
And were a lot of people watching the president's presentation?
There were more people still kind of talking about Ohio State's fortunes, misfortunes in the NCAA basketball tournament and the like. There was not a great deal of buzz about it, kind of in diners, on the street. You bring it up and opinions would be all over the place, but it wasn't topic number one.
What was topic number one in terms of the politics of Columbus this past week?
Ohio has a new Republican-controlled legislature and a new Republican governor. He's a former congressman, a former U.S. House budget chairman.
John Kasich.
John Kasich. And let's just say, like Wisconsin, like Michigan, he is not being shy about seizing this opportunity to really change how Ohio is run. And this week, the House and Senate both passed a very tough bill. It's called Senate Bill 5 that really dramatically limits public sector unions' ability to negotiate contracts.
So it's the collective bargaining issue we see in Wisconsin. Only in the Ohio case, they're limiting the collective bargaining rights of public employees even more, as I understand
it. It includes police and fire. They were not covered under the changes that prompted all of those protests. So there have been protests not quite as big as the ones in Wisconsin that have drawn tens of thousands, 100,000 people. But there have been protests, including this week, and it really does feel like a showdown moment. And it comes even as the governor travels the state pushing a separate but related issue, his budget, which has to address, say, an $8 billion projected deficit over the next 2 years. So there are cuts to education, cuts to revenue sharing and aid to cities and municipalities. His argument is, yes, you're going to see these deep cuts, Mr. Mayor, Mr. County Executive, but the things that Senate Bill 5 does, the collective bargaining bill, and some of the other things we're going to enact will allow you to save so much money that it'll offset these cuts from the state.
So we're essentially going back to an earlier, perhaps even Robert Taft era, understanding of the relationship between Columbus and the towns of Ohio, much as in other states, and this is really a template for what's going on in much of the country. In other states, the state capital, whoever is in charge, usually a new Republican governor, and in many, many cases, a new Republican-dominated legislature, is saying, we're going to go back to a different relationship between the state capital and the various municipalities and local governments, in which the state capital matters less, and the statewide tax base, that is not going to be shared in the same way that it has been in the past. In a sense, you're going to be more on your own.
Exactly. And a lot of the people out there protesting are complaining that they're bearing the bulk of the cuts. They notice that there are proposed new cuts in business taxes and other big costly business incentives. The governor says, hey, we can't ask businesses to pay any more. We can't raise taxes on them, even a nickel, because guess what? They'll go elsewhere. They're going to go to Wisconsin. They're going to go to Indiana. They're going to go down south somewhere.
They're going to go wherever the taxes are lowest,
Wherever
the labor costs are the lowest. That's the double payoff in a lot of these administrations around the country. And something very much like that is the inspiring spirit of the Tea Party Revolution that has 86, 87 new seats in the House of Representatives. Not all of them are Tea Party associated, but that's a big freshman class. It's more than a third of the overall Republican majority, and they have many sympathizers among some of the more senior Republicans in the House as well. So they're really in charge in the House of Representatives, and John Boehner, who is the Speaker and has to negotiate with the Democrats in the Senate and has to negotiate with the White House, really has to keep looking over his shoulder constantly at that big group of freshmen, plus all of their other sympathizers who like the Tea Party maybe better than they like being called Republicans, certainly like being called conservatives more. And that's what's making it so difficult for the negotiations to go forward toward a new continuing resolution to keep the federal government operating past, well, I guess it's only 1 week away, April 8th.
These Tea Party activists, they call themselves purists. They will tell you that compromise is not something they embrace, and that puts Boehner in a very difficult place.
So with John Boehner in that kind of situation, he has to look wherever he can. I mean, beyond his own 241 Republicans, he's got to look to find some people to replace the votes of those people who are purists, as you say. And those folks are going to have to probably be Democrats, like Blue Dog Democrats, who are in somewhat short supply after last November's election.
The irony is that the Democrats who were most likely to lose were the ones that these Tea Party members might find that they have the most in common with. I'm not saying a lot in common with, but I'm saying the most in common with.
One of the big reasons that a shutdown is a real possibility at this point is because, as you say, in the 2008 election, a lot of moderate to conservative Democrats lost. In the 2006 election, a lot of moderate Republicans lost to more liberal Democrats. So you lost a lot of the people in the middle in both parties in the last two cycles. So we're really down to a negotiation between the harder left and the harder right. And that leaves John Boehner in a situation where he may literally not be able to cobble together a majority for a continuing resolution. And that would mean another government shutdown, even though everyone keeps saying, including the Republicans, including the Democrats, they don't want one.
So talking to Governor Kasich this past week, he, of course, was a member of Congress in 1995.
The last time we had a government shutdown, 1995 and 96 in January.
He's watching this closely. Obviously, it'll affect the states. He said he doesn't think it happens. He thinks ultimately they work something out. Is that the 1995 mindset at work there?
Or? Well, the people who survived that in 95 and 96 have largely looked back on it as being the turning point where the energy of their conservative revolution from 94, what we sometimes call the Gingrich Revolution, was dissipated, and the public seemed to move over to thinking maybe Bill Clinton was a little closer to their point of view. And that was partly because Newt Gingrich had said some things that were sort of inflammatory and that made him look like the guy who hit the brakes on the negotiations, and maybe it was a little petty. It was also partly because a lot of Republicans at that time were engaging in rhetoric on the floor of the House and elsewhere back in their districts about why would it be such a terrible thing if the federal government shut down for a while. Maybe people won't even notice. Maybe the government isn't that important a part of your life. And that seemed to make many of the voters at least feel that the Republicans were glad to have it or willing to have it or certainly not averse to having some kind of government shutdown. We're not seeing that kind of rhetoric this time. But one wonders when you see the Tea Party rallying today on Capitol Hill and saying no to the negotiations and saying no, there shouldn't be any compromises on the cuts we want to see, wondering whether or not all those Tea Party people would not be at least willing to accept a short government shutdown to enforce the discipline on these new Republicans that they want to see.
And what's your take on how the White House is playing this? Certainly, Vice President Biden has been involved in the negotiations on the Hill, but the president's been doing a lot of other things and kind of keeping his distance.
He's been keeping his distance because he likes to think that this will all be worked out at a lower level and he won't have to get his hands dirty with it. And there are a lot of elements of the dealings with Congress where that applies. He had the experience of the first 2 years he was in office and all the things that went on with the health care bill. And you could imagine them thinking, oh, here goes Congress again. They're going to lower everyone's opinion of the federal government with their horse trading and some of their sort of cynical deals that they will cut. We want to keep the president as far away from that as we possibly can. But at the same time, there's really no one who can bring the House and Senate, controlled by two different parties, together other than the president or the White House and some guys, maybe Bill Daley, the chief of staff. Right now, the lead guy is Joe Biden, the vice president, and he's in the midst of these negotiations by which the Republicans' $61 billion in cuts in this current budget is being whittled down, and we've heard the number $33 billion floated. And apparently, by at least some White House sources, the difference between the Republican negotiating position and the Democrats is down to about $6 billion, not so much out of a $3.7 trillion federal budget.
And the message becomes, if it comes to this, you're willing to shut the government down over this tiny sliver of a sliver.
That's right. That's right. And of course, the Tea Party people who are rallying on the Hill today are saying, look, it's not just the $6 billion. We don't want the compromise on $33 billion. We thought $61 billion was a compromise. We feel like this is moving in the wrong direction, and we want to turn it around and get it going back up to higher billions of cuts.
Have you learned anything from November? Is their question.
Then the interesting thing is that their wrath here does not seem to be directed so much at the Democrats who are pushing against them. It's at the Republicans, and particularly the freshman Republicans who are most on their side. Those are the offices where they're showing up with their signs.
And while the Tea Party is making its presence felt, the president is dealing with Libya, a major speech on that, and toss in another speech on energy. His second big speech on energy in about a month.
So here's the bottom line. There are no quick fixes. Anybody who tells you otherwise isn't telling you the truth. And we will keep on being a victim to shifts in the oil market until we finally get serious about a long-term policy for a secure, affordable energy future.
Certainly it's an important domestic policy issue. Certainly people have nuclear power on their mind after what we've seen play out in Japan after this tsunami. But can you get any traction for a speech like that in the middle of all this?
Not in terms of energy policy, I don't believe. I don't think that the president is continuing this series of energy speeches strictly because he wants to move our energy policy. I think that's a goal. But the other goal that he's pursuing here is he wants to show that the president is the president of all the issues. The president has all these different things on his mind. There's Libya, there's energy, there's the budget, and certainly the economy and creating jobs is still the base of everyone's political concern. So he does not want to appear to be 100% focused on Libya or 100% focused on these budget negotiations. It's grubby to get into the details of any one issue too far, and it's much more presidential, particularly for somebody who's gearing up a reelection campaign that I believe is going to officially be kicked off in April. Any president in that position wants to put himself above the fray at the same time that he shows himself as interested in and engaged in all the issues.
And we do have $4 a gallon gasoline.
Not a bad time to be giving some kind of an energy speech. And people do care about the price of gasoline, just as they care about the unemployment rate. And the president is taken in all these different directions at once.
I mean, we're talking about gas prices. We're talking about energy.
Big spike in gas.
These topics cause us to look to the Middle East. And there's all the unrest in Libya, military operation now, the president's speech. Let's give a listen to what he said this week.
To brush aside America's responsibility as a leader, and more profoundly, our responsibilities to our fellow human beings under such circumstances, would have been a betrayal of who we are. Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. And as president, I refuse to wait for the images of slaughter and mass graves before taking action.
So the president really has taken the bull by the horns here, in a sense, because for weeks, months, we've been watching this uprising throughout the Muslim world, the Middle Eastern Muslim world, and we have been wondering where we should be on it. We were on one side and the other side in Egypt. We thought it was great in Tunisia. We're a little bit more afraid of it in Bahrain because of the relationship we have with the Saudis and their relationship with Bahrain. It's very confusing. And then in Libya, suddenly a moment of what you might call clarity, where the rebels are essentially driven back to their stronghold in Benghazi and the Gaddafi forces are about to massacre them. And finally, the European, NATO, United Nations communities all come together. We go after Gaddafi. And the Poles, well, they didn't exactly go totally into the tank.
And what would you expect to happen when there's this kind of a military operation is there is sort of a rallying around. You would expect the Poles to maybe bump upward a little bit. That certainly didn't happen. And I was very interested to see that the criticism was not, and the praise, were not divided by party. They were divided within party. You had progressive Democrats criticizing him, other Democrats saying, we need to do this, and you had the same divide on the Republican side. The neocons love it. The Pat Buchanan wing, not so much.
That's right. And in this particular case, the approval of this military action, while it was hovering around 50% in the initial days right after the no-fly zone was declared, 50%, that's a very poor rallying around effect. That's hovering around where the president's general approval level was at the time. And then the president gives this speech, and that doesn't seem to have helped dramatically. And at the same time, the fortunes of the rebels, which had picked up and improved with the airstrikes on their behalf, now their fortunes seem to be deteriorating again. They're on the retreat again. It's very unclear how Gaddafi is going to be removed by any of this. So we could wind up with a situation of stalemate, and it's going to pull us further and further in if we really want to see Gaddafi removed from power.
And even if the president addressed the why in this speech, and people will disagree on whether or not he did. But even if you stipulate to that, there's just a lot we don't know. We don't know who the rebels are, really. We don't know how long this will take. And a lot of people are offering the reassurance that there will be no boots on the ground, that this is not going to be that kind of a situation. But that doesn't mean people aren't wondering about what this does eventually lead to.
And, of course, we already know that the CIA is present. We don't count those perhaps as boots on the ground, maybe sneakers. But we do know that we have some personnel in this country, and we've weighed in along with our allies. Maybe it was the right thing to do. Maybe history will judge. But from a political standpoint, this is all highly hazardous territory. Maybe the president didn't have much choice. He didn't particularly want to be responsible for the massacre of Benghazi, the way Bill Clinton was in some quarters held responsible for the massacre at Srebrenica in Bosnia back in the 1990s when he didn't act in time and took a long time to put together a coalition. It may have been something that was going to be a kind of torpedo in the water for the Barack Obama reelection campaign either way. And there was nothing they could do to keep it from being so. They simply had to go one direction or another and take their lumps in one direction or another.
A stunning reminder of how the president doesn't necessarily get to choose what he talks about. He does not absolutely get to choose what lands on his plate. The president would like to be talking about the economy and jobs every single day, and we're not hearing a lot of that.
Before we leave this week, we do want to note the passing of Geraldine Ferraro, former congresswoman from New York, and of course, the woman who broke the glass ceiling on an American major party nomination ticket. She was nominated for vice president by the Democratic Party in 1984.
Of course, it's interesting to watch the old footage, especially after the 2008 election we had, where Hillary Clinton looked like she might be the nominee for at least, through New Hampshire.
Many months of 2007.
Exactly. And, of course, the Sarah Palin nomination on the Republican ticket. But watching Ferraro's speech again from that night in 1984 at the convention, it was quite a moment in American politics.
It was an electrifying moment.
I stand before you to proclaim tonight America is the land where dreams can come true for all of us.
And that was in many respects the peak of her career. The campaign did not go well. Walter Mondale lost 49 states. After that, she ran a couple of times for the Senate, unsuccessfully didn't get the Democratic nomination. But in recent years, she was a spokesperson for the Hillary Clinton campaign for a period of time. She has appeared as a Fox News commentator, and she has battled for a number of years a form of blood cancer to which she succumbed this past week.
Former Congresswoman, former Democratic nominee for Vice President, Geraldine Ferraro, passing away at age 75.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Don Gagne. Ken will be back next week, I'm told.
Yes, but join us again anyway next week for It's All Politics from NPR.